Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Governor Mike DeWine this week asked lawmakers to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarette products in Ohio. The request came as concerns grow about the health effects of vaping. The governor said the proposed ban is intended to protect children.
Our focus will remain on young people. That's where I think that we have a moral obligation. I think it's the responsible thing for us to do.
We're talking about the health risks of vaping and how it's affecting young people. Dr. Peter Shields is a thoracic oncologist and deputy director of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, Arthur G. James Cancer Hospital, and Richard J. Soloff Research Institute. Welcome to the show. Dr. Shields?
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. OSU is expanding its vaping research studies to study younger children. That being said, what did you make of the governor's announcement yesterday?
So I think there's a lot to unpack there. We are all very, very concerned about the rapidly increasing number of kids who are using e-cig products. A lot to say that it has to do with the flavors, and it seems like a very prudent thing to do. There are concerns about the impact of smokers who are using e-cigs to quit. A lot of people say they are, and they'll go back to smoking if it's gone. But there are ways to handle that, too. So the proposal is to remove the flavors like gummy bear and things that are attractive to kids, but leave on the market the e-cigs that are tobacco flavored. So smokers are used to that, and they can continue to get those.
Is there any suggestion that these incidents, 800 and growing now across the country, are affecting younger people more than older people? Do we know?
So we don't know. I mean, right now, there's a whole lot of cases around the country, but these are still case reports. We don't really have a good systematic evaluation of the collection of these cases or what these folks look like. Clearly, there's a lot of young people, but most of the cases appear to not be using the sort of conventional nicotine-containing electronic cigarettes, but are vaping with marijuana products like THC and CBD and that sort of thing. Those tend to happen by young people, and so we're seeing more young people getting these very severe respiratory illnesses.
When you first heard about the whole vaping thing, what did you think as a thoracic oncologist? I mean, your understanding of lungs and whatnot, what did it suggest to you?
So I'm sorry, so which whole vaping thing, like when electronic cigarettes first came out? Or
when it first started coming out, what did you think about what kind of challenges it could pose?
So that's a really interesting question, because we would love in the public health community more or additional effective ways to help smokers quit. And so e-cigs presented that as a possibility, still not quite proven. Mm-hmm. But if we have another tool, wouldn't that be fabulous? It's certainly something that delivers nicotine in ways better for smokers than sort of a nicotine patch or nicotine gum. And we were also concerned about, what these products would do to the lungs. There's a lot of studies now, including ours, that suggests they don't do a lot of the damage that you see for typical smoking, like carcinogenic pathways, things that cause cancer. But we're always concerned that there may be something unique to e-cigs because of their composition. And so those studies have been actively ongoing, and now we're faced with this, what looks like an epidemic across the country of acute lung toxicity that may or may not have anything to do with the regular e-cigs. But if it's all THC vaping, then the THC oils are actually a different composition. Plus, there's a lot of case reports that people are altering their devices or cutting the THC oils with other chemicals so that they either are cheaper or maybe are considered more effective.
What kind of studies is OSU doing?
So we've had several studies over the last couple of years where we were bringing in smokers, e-cig users, and never smokers and doing a procedure, what's called a bronchoscopy. So it's a tube that goes through the nose, it's a 20-minute procedure that samples the lung. And so that we were able to look directly at the differences of the lungs, for example, inflammation between smokers, never smokers, and e-cig users. Then we had a second study, which was a small study where we brought some never smokers in, and we trained about half of them to smoke a e-cig that was nicotine and flavor-free, so it was only the carriers, so we could see what would happen over the month. I mean, these are products that people are buying. Those chemicals are generally considered safe by the FDA, at least when eaten or used in cosmetics. So we've been doing that. Now with what's going on across the country, we are sort of a full-court press now expanding these studies. So we're about to open up and actively recruit THC vapers. We want more e-cig users. We actually want to look at people who might be vaping with medical marijuana. You know, this whole acute toxicity has opened up a whole bunch of questions about the safety of e-cigs. If they're not safe and there are issues, then we need to know that, of course. If these are rare, unusual events for e-cig users, let's say it's 1 in 100,000 users or something, but e-cigs turn out to be effective devices to help people quit, then that's part of the informed consent process. You know, any medicine we take sometimes have very serious reactions. And then you have to tie into, if you want to help smokers quit, do we even need those flavors on the market that are attractive to kids? Maybe we could just do that with tobacco e-cigs. So it's like three trains going on parallel track.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about e-cigarettes right now. The governor has asked the Ohio General Assembly to ban the flavored e-cigarettes. We're talking about, you know, what we know so far. My guest is Dr. Peter Shields. He's a thoracic oncologist and deputy director of the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shields, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You talked about the carriers, Dr. Shields. That's without the flavor, without the nicotine, without the THC, whatever it is that's carrying any of those things into the lungs. What are they? What is that stuff? It looks like a mist when I see people using it.
Right. So that is a combination generally of two chemicals, propylene glycol and glycerin. These are moisturizers in food. They're moisturizers in cosmetics. There's been a lot of studies that if you eat them as part of your foods to keep them moist, there's no apparent health effects. But the question is, what happens when they get heated? You know, when they hit the coils inside those e-cigs, they get aerosolized. And you do get some chemicals produced as byproducts. Most of them are not even close to the levels that you get from cigarette smoke. But there also are things that we don't know to measure. And that's one of the things that's going on with these lung toxicities across the country because, you know, we have been very focused on things that, you know, are pathways for cancer, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And it looks like, although it's early, that these lung toxicities are related to a whole different pathway affecting fats and lipids and the structure of the lungs. And honestly, a year ago, we weren't even thinking about looking at that. Of course, now we're court press in that area.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's studies going on about the effects of air pollution on lungs, too. I mean, to me, the propylene glycol and the glycerin issue, that's when we eat it in foods, not when we put it in our lungs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, our studies do indicate that these things may be, and they're small and it's early, mm-hmm. And there's other studies, that it may be, you know, a lot better than smoking. Now, there may be still unique things to e-cigs. And so the issue is really, in the whole public health debate, I hate to say it this way, but do you care more about kids or do you care more about, you know, smokers who want to quit? Or obviously, how do we address both of them?
Or make them a prescription-only type of thing.
You could do that. When nicotine patches and gums were prescription-only, that was kind of a disaster because no one got to use it. So, you know, we may have to make decisions, you know, but tobacco still remains incredibly high. Too many kids are still smoking. There are people who attribute the reduction in cigarette smoking among kids now because they're using e-cigs and getting nicotine addicted instead. If there's no e-cigs available to them, would these kids become smokers and have, you know, lifelong smoking problems, you know, like other smokers? You know, it's amazing because there are some counties in Ohio where we still have a 30 to 40% smoking rate. So it depends on the perspective you want to start off as you're checking off your boxes. Mm. You know, stopping smoking among adults or increasing nicotine, among kids. And of course, you know, I think the world right now is clearly, you know, going towards the hard data we know is that too many kids are using e-cigs. Mm-hmm. We don't know whether e-cigs yet are helping people quit enough. And so, in that equation, based on known data, I think, and this has been an evolution over, you know, even the last 6 to 12 months, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's better to ban flavors as long as we have tobacco flavors available.
Now, the dangers of nicotine. Nicotine's a stimulant, right?
Yeah, it does a lot of things. It's amazing because if you think about it, for people who are depressed, it makes them a little less depressed. For people who are anxious, it makes them a little less anxious. For people who are weight conscious, and that's one of the reasons why young adolescent women smoke, is because it helps keep their weight down and increases metabolism. So I hate to say it, but it's almost...
Oh, looks like we've lost Dr. Shields. We'll try to get him back for just a quick minute. I want to hear more about the dangers of nicotine or what the effects of nicotine are. He was just telling us that it has a lot of different properties, or it can affect a lot of different people in different ways. Depression, weight loss, a little energy boost. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shields, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just to refresh your memory, Governor DeWine yesterday asked the Ohio General Assembly to ban flavored e-cigarettes. The idea is that that's what's attracting so much interest from younger people. There's been a huge uptick in the number of young people vaping. If you have a question or comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Shields, are you there? Well, then we're going to have to call it off. We will be back with more Wellness Wednesday coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Ohio Department of Health last week reported the first human West Nile virus case and death in Ohio this year. It comes amid concerns of a potential nationwide outbreak of another deadly mosquito-borne disease, Eastern equine encephalitis. Dr. Daniel Cameron is a Lyme disease doctor, epidemiologist, and researcher practicing in Mount Kisco, New York. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
West Nile virus, equine encephalitis, Lyme disease, the common denominator with all of these is the mosquito, right?
Well, the mosquito is for West Nile and Eastern equine encephalitis, but the tick usually gets blamed for almost everything else. And so, you know, you're on the yard and there's airborne issues with these viruses, but they're tick-borne from the ground.
Is there much of a distinction? Are they similar kinds of diseases, or do they present very differently?
Well, the viruses, most of the West Nile and Eastern equine encephalitis, most people are well, or it's just that a small number get encephalitis, and that's the one that catches the attention and what most of the CDC and is worried about is why do some people get so sick with a deadly presentation, whereas Lyme disease from a tick, even though it's occasional death, it ends up with acute and chronic disease, but they're both what you might get in your backyard.
What is West Nile virus?
West Nile is is a virus that certain ticks, certain mosquitoes carry it, and it causes just a generalized illness. Some people are not sick at all. In fact, a lot of people aren't sick from it. It's just that if you're really, really sick, it can cause an encephalitis or death. The same thing can happen with the three E's, mm-hmm. Eastern equine encephalitis.
That some people get it and it doesn't bother them. It tends to be then something that can exacerbate an existing illness.
Yeah, they originally thought that it was a deadly illness until they go back into communities and look at West Nile and people who live in those same areas. And an endless amount of people had West Nile without ever knowing it. And so then you end up having to decide clinically if you have a West Nile. Now, what I run into, because I work with ticks and Lyme disease a lot, mm-hmm. is that there can be more than one illness that the doctor is worried about. So they might have to test for West Nile, but they also have to test for Lyme disease at the same time. You know, it can get in trouble if you focus only on one of the mosquito or tick-borne illnesses without considering that there's around 17 tick-borne and mosquito-borne illnesses identified by the CDC already that are giving people trouble.
I didn't start talking about Lyme disease much on the program until maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So it's moving across the country, right?
Right. In Ohio, there's all around it. Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin had a huge number of cases. Pennsylvania. And so there certainly weren't many cases from Ohio, but there was a study that said, well, it may not get reported to the CDC, but there's plenty of the right kind of ticks and infected ticks in Ohio that I'm not surprised that the Ohio residents are facing tick-borne illnesses. Canada even thought they were okay until they realized they weren't okay.
Is it that there's a tick variety that tends to carry it more that's migrating, or is it just passing through the ticks?
Well, I think that whenever you have a rule that a tick is in a certain state, we have birds that are carrying ticks to Canada, mm-hmm. Millions of ticks, but they're also carrying them east and west. So therefore, where we think we have a safe area, like Ohio, it's that when you look a second time, they've been there and they're getting, they're spreading. And so that's why that the CDC has to face both these mosquito-borne viruses and these tick-borne infections.
Do these infections or viruses affect the mosquitoes?
It doesn't seem like they affect the mosquitoes. They don't seem to affect the ticks either. It seems like they just kind of are an accident of nature, and they don't kill the ticks, bother the ticks, or the mosquitoes. When it comes to these mosquitoes that give these viruses, it's they don't reside in people. They just show up, and we just are an accident of nature that we just happen to be a recipient of a mosquito bite or a tick bite, and so then we get sick sometimes. In fact, quite often we get sick.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that climate change is playing a role in all of this. What is your understanding of that?
My understanding is that there's more time for ticks to divide and ticks to procreate, make more ticks. And same with mosquitoes, you know, because we're always waiting now for the frost to get rid of all these mosquitoes. These encephalitis things, but ticks don't seem to get killed off very well with a cold Ohio winter. You know, they did a study in Connecticut and found that 2/3 of ticks could get through a typical winter, and Ohio has bad winters, so ticks are pretty hardy. And then in the spring, when a tick gets hungry and wants a meal, they just happen to give a lot of infections that people in Ohio have to worry about.
Is that why they're telling us if people with dogs and cats to have flea and tick prevention year round now?
Yeah, because it only takes a little bit of heat, like maybe, you know, 30s for a tick to warm up and see if it gets lucky and gets a meal. And so then you get these warm places where mice are hiding and other animals are hiding, and the ticks are ready to and might get on your dog in the winter. And so that anytime you have a dog in bed or a dog in your couch, is that they might bring in a tick when you don't expect it, when you're not doing tick checks.
How do you know? I mean, what is there any common denominator when, let's talk about Eastern equine encephalitis. That's in the news these days. You're saying a lot of times people don't present right away. They don't know. They feel fine.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that feel fine. So, you know, in fact, the horses sometimes get in trouble. And so we pay attention to when horses get bit. And that means that there's infected mosquitoes in the area. And so then we don't know who's going to get bit and get encephalitis because there is no treatment. Direct treatment for encephalitis or West Nile, all we can do is if you're that unlucky person who gets encephalitis or severely sick, you end up in the hospital and all they can do is give you fluids that they can support you, give good nursing care, but there's no treatment. There's also no vaccines that you can rely on to prevent those infections.
Is that something that they're working on, epidemiologists, to create vaccines for these or not?
I believe the encephalitis, Eastern equine encephalitis, there's some early work, but not at the clinical trial where you need to do clinical trials before you can actually see if it works. You also have to decide if people are willing to take vaccines because there's only you know, a handful of serious encephalitis cases from a mosquito. And so will people sign up for another vaccine or two more vaccines for something that doesn't happen very often?
Hmm.
You know, it's deadly, but it's still important.
Right, right. The bird kills are one way that we find out if these are a problem, right?
Right, there's a lot of birds that get infected, but it seems like crows are a good example of a bird that somehow can die and be found in yards. So yeah, that crows and horses are warning that there's a Eastern equine encephalitis in the area.
Why crows?
I don't think they figured out why crows are more susceptible than a lot of the other birds. Seems like the mosquito that carries it likes birds, but I don't know why birds are more susceptible. But in Westchester County, New York, where I practiced, there were a fair amount of dead crows around during a wave of West Nile. Now it seems like they keep discovering West Nile and keep discovering Eastern equine encephalitis all over the country. Where you wouldn't expect it, including the Michigan area.
Why wouldn't you expect it there?
Well, I think that they talk about these mosquitoes spreading, but I think sometimes they just don't get discovered right away. It takes a while for entomologists to look, but they certainly are finding infected mosquitoes now. But I think it's rare. It takes longer to find it. I think the people looking at horses that were actually helpful at discovering the mosquito before people.
You know, when I was a kid growing up, I don't remember these kinds of things. Is this a relatively new phenomenon, or is it just because we're discovering it in recent decades?
I grew up in Minnesota, and I didn't really see deer ticks that I can think of, just dog ticks.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's less insecticides being used in neighborhoods. So my pet theory, and everyone has their own pet theory, is that DDT was pretty effective at getting rid of mosquitoes and ticks for many neighborhoods. And so that when we banned DDT, that sometimes it gave you a chance to get a resurgence of these insects. Now, other people think that it's, you know, when you break up the woods into lawns,
mm-hmm.
that ticks and mosquitoes like that open cover, open areas in the yard. And,
mm-hmm.
That may be part of it. There's longer seasons for mosquitoes than there were in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to protect ourselves?
Well, certainly DEET, the CDC advises, has confused mosquitoes because the mosquitoes might not identify that you're a host, that you're a source of blood. And whereas DEET is not so clear in my mind on ticks, because once a tick touches you, it tends to look for a meal. So pyrethrin seems to work for both diseases, but that's an insecticide that you put into your clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, getting rid of freestanding water as much as possible in your yard and in the neighborhood helps prevent mosquitoes. Insecticides helps mosquitoes and ticks, but then you have to deal with all the problems with insecticides. So they're trying to come up with something for both diseases, and all tick-borne diseases, but they're the cases keep climbing instead of dropping.
Should we limit our time outside at night?
Well, in ticks really are around day and night, so I don't think it matters much for them. But mosquitoes, many of them will feed more at night and more when it's a little cooler. And so that's why you see these precautions, they change football games to the daytime when you're more likely to see a mosquito or more likely to not get bitten. So, but I think every mosquito is different,
mm-hmm.
and how they bite, when they bite, and who they bite.
What about clothes?
Well, there's clothes that if you put pyrethrin, which is an insecticide, in clothes, it can help prevent both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if the, I think probably long pants might prevent ticks, or at least cut down the number if you tuck them in the socks, but who tucks them in the socks very often?
Yeah.
And that's a problem with, so that's why they always recommend tick checks, because all these other measures don't seem to work as well as a good tick check.
We medicate our pets for flea and ticks routinely now. Why can't we be medicated for them?
Well, it seems like the vaccine didn't take off with people. You know, anything you give to somebody, you know, they might trigger a disease or a problem. So it's hard to find a good vaccine that's reliable that people will buy. Whereas with dogs, they seem to have a vaccine. But because there's, you know, so many different things in a tick now, even the dog vaccine isn't, you know, it still has its problems. There's some dogs still getting
mm-hmm.
Lyme, and there's other bacteria in the tick that the vaccine might not work for. So I think the vets are still working out the best way to protect the dog. But lastly, because even if you try to protect the dog, a tick that crawling across the fur of a dog,
mm-hmm.
When it sees you sitting there on the couch or in the bed, some of those ticks will move over and would rather bite you than to bite the dog with the who's been treated or who has that front line on.
Dr. Cameron, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dr. Daniel Cameron is a Lyme disease doctor, epidemiologist, and researcher based in New York. We have a little bit more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Rob McClanahan tried out for the Syracuse men's basketball team 20 years ago. He made it in as a walk-on. But for him, the experience turned out to be more of a training ground for training professional basketball players. He's written a book about his time as a professional trainer in the new book, Network, Training the NBA's Best and Finding the Keys to Greatness. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Rob McClanahan joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. 20 years ago. I feel old now.
Time flies. Well, I can make you feel a lot younger. The NBA superstars you've worked with are who even I have heard of them. Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, to name just a few. You said you're often asked why these star athletes trust a former walk-on from Rhode Island. How do you respond?
Yeah, that's a heck of a question. I'm still trying to figure that out. Yeah, listen, I think from the beginning, you know, I met these guys. I've treated them like men, and not like all-stars, you know, like MVPs or basketball players. And I've held them accountable, and I've made them be honest with as far as their efficiency, their workouts, their accountability, things like that. And I think they like that. I think a lot of these guys grew up as prodigies and grew up, you know, with people telling them it's okay. And really, you know, if they don't work hard, you know, they might say, oh, yeah, great workout. And I kind of approach them differently since the beginning for some reason. I have no idea why. But and they like that. I think they want honesty. And these guys want to be great. So they want someone to push them to be great.
Have you ever dropped anybody?
Dropped anybody?
Yeah. Who doesn't want to work as hard as you think they need to?
Yeah. I mean, I push guys to the limit of giving guys chances. But there's probably one or two guys that, you know, they want to come twice a week instead of 5 days a week. They want to put in the time. So, and I look at it like this. If you have any other job, you have to work 5-6 days a week and show up on time and be there. So why not this? And it's only for an hour. So, yeah, there's been one or two guys that just hasn't really worked out.
I thought it was interesting when I was reading about this that people, a signal, a red flag for you is when somebody says, why do we have to do this?
Yes. That's only happened a couple of times. It's funny because the great players you just talked about, like Steph, the Durant, the John Walls, Kevin Love, they've never questioned any drill I've ever done, honestly. I can't remember one time. But the other guys that are, you know, not even all-stars, not even starters per se, a couple of guys that have, you know, questioned maybe a drill here and there and things like that just don't work out. You know, if you're going to hire someone like me, just trust me, trust the process, and let's get there together.
Hmm. What's the magic in an hour?
That's a good question. I mean, it's funny. Sometimes I don't even go an hour, but my workouts are very efficient, very to the point, not a lot of talking. I try to approach it and simulate a game as much as I can. So in a game on TV, it's 2.5 hours, but really, you know, it's not. It's 48 minutes of actually playing minutes. So, you know, in essence, guys are playing 40 minutes, and I try to approach it like that. 40 minutes to an hour will simulate a game, and that way, when they go to a game and they play, you know, let's say 40, 45 minutes, it's kind of like a workout. So I try to do my best to, you know, go one half, per se, little water break, go hard in the second half, and we're done.
The training style, is it different for everybody, or is there sort of a regimen that you apply and adapt to all of your different clients?
Yeah, there's some of the same drills I use for everybody, but definitely everybody is different as well. Things we need to improve on, things we need to get better at. Yeah, I'm a big fan of working on your strengths as much as your weaknesses. I think nowadays, I think in any industry, people worry about their weaknesses too much. But with me, let's work on what you're already good at. Let's get better at that. You know, Steph Curry, you shot 50% for three last year. That's good. Mm-hmm. Why not try to get to 53%? That's kind of the way I approach it. But now the basketball game is way different than it even was 10 years ago. Everyone kind of is a shooter now, and there's no really big men per se anymore. So the training has changed definitely a little bit since, you know, the Steph Curry, I guess, the Steph Curry NBA.
These guys, when I'm watching the games, it they just look like gods out there, physical, amazing physical specimens. And in 20 years, you have to have seen a lot of changes in the people that you're training, right?
Oh, big time. I mean, you know, we know a lot more now than we ever knew, you know, even when I was growing up in, like, say, the 90s. We didn't know a ton about the body. And now with the research they've done, recovery, the way lifting has changed, you know, no one's really doing heavy lifting anymore like people thought you had to.
Mm-hmm.
But people are definitely leaner, stronger, recover better, eat better. That's a major, major thing. Nutrition has changed a ton, you know, with organic stuff and in diets per se. So yeah, Kevin Love's a great example of that. You know, when I met Kevin Love, when he was 17 years old, he was definitely overweight, to be the first to tell you. And if you look at him when he was 18 to now, I mean, he's a different human being. And it's just because he's learned how to sleep, eat, you know, treat his body. And again, we know so much more now than we knew 20 years ago.
When you said earlier that when you're talking to them, you know, when you're training them, you train them like they're men, not like they're these superstars, these prodigies,
yeah.
Who have been sort of catered to their whole lives. Does it change much when you're just training ordinary people, or do you ever try to train ordinary people?
Yeah, I do. I train a lot of kids. You know, my first two clients were a brother and a sister who were like 12 years old back in 2003. So I love training kids. I love seeing, you know, let's say 12-year-old kind of mature and get better as he or she gets, you know, better up until their varsity year, let's say college. So that's really cool to see the transformation they make. And I treat Kevin Durant the same way I treat a 12-year-old kid, honestly. It's the same thing. The parents want, you know, accountability and efficiency and, you know, and to get the most out of that hour with me. So nothing's really changed from when I trained a 12-year-old kid to, you know, Steph Curry, because it's the same, honestly, same kind of workout. It's just, you know, obviously the NBA guys, you know, make more shots.
What about the mental piece of this? That's a big part of every sport now, you know, from golfing to basketball.
Yeah. I mean, the game has changed, I think, you know, so much that the way I train these guys, it changed for me too. You know, I've had to approach it differently the past 5 years, quite honestly, because everyone now in the NBA is a shooter. You know, back 15 years ago, we had a lot of centers, 7-foot guys that just played inside. And, you know, with now with Steph Curry, James Harden, Klay Thompson, Kevin Durant, if you can't shoot in the NBA now, it's really going to be hard to stay in the NBA.
How does that change? How does that change the routine of the workout? You just, they got to get in a position to shoot, so they have to sprint more. I don't know what.
Yeah. That's a valid question. Well, I think the way that the game has been is coached now, they're putting players in position to shoot threes, to play on the perimeter per se. You know, so a good example of Brook Lopez, who's a 7-foot-1 player. I trained him in 2008, 2009, 2010, and we did all stuff inside. And the game has changed so much, he realized 2 summers ago, I need to work on my threes. And he went in, and he got a minimum deal with Milwaukee. We worked on threes all summer. He made $2 million that year. And he was one of the best shooters on the team last year in Milwaukee this summer because he worked out a shot, and he signed $54 million.
Hmm.
You know, so I think guys have realized, you know, they have to adapt to the game now because it's really, really changed.
Hmm. And the injuries, how do you respond to those? Has that changed the kinds of injuries they get?
Yeah, I mean, I've dealt with guys with pretty bad injuries. Derek Rose, John Wall just got hurt towards Achilles. You don't really approach it any different than the way you train. It's just a matter of being patient with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the game. It really is. And the game, as you said, is just these guys are specimens. It's so physical now. And, you know, guys get injured, just have to – luckily, when you get injured, you know, if you're on a contract, you still get paid, unlike, let's say, a football. So that's good. But you have to be patient. I think guys sometimes rush back too quick. And if you do that, then you're talking maybe more long-term stuff. But with me, it's just the same thing. It's just being patient with them and not – these guys are competitive. They want to get back as soon as they can, but that's not really smart long-term.
Are there other sports that you train with people in?
No. So it's all basketball, all on the court. Skill work, just basketball. But
was there a day when they would take off between seasons and kind of get fat and happy and you'd have to slap them back into shape? Or is it kind of a 24/7, 365 routine these days?
Yeah, it's pretty much 24/7. I mean, guys fly me in during the season as well. So in the summer, I do all my training in L.A. Mm-hmm. There are some guys that sometimes maybe take too much time off, a little more catching up to do.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, most of the guys I train really take care of their bodies. So even when they're not working out, you know, they need to hop in the treadmill, eat well. So they don't really have a lot of catching up to do.
I'm wondering, and I'm wondering if you're thinking about this, you know, after their professional sport life ends, how, you know, a lot of times you see them, they gain a lot of weight, they get out of shape, they just don't look that good. Is there a lifelong lesson here for them?
Yes, definitely. And I think, again, guys, we know so much more about the body as far as, you know, the eating part and the way people lift and treat their bodies. You know, we have NBA teams that have sleep doctors now. And they teach me things, you know, little things like, you know, I was told last year, hey, don't, if you're going to take a nap, take a 15-minute nap or 2-hour nap. Because that 1-hour nap, you're not in a deep enough sleep where you get up, you're more tired. So I'm learning this stuff too. So I think these guys that learning all this stuff and then they retire, let's say 35 years old,
mm-hmm.
You know, they leave the team knowing how to take care of their body. And these guys are in such great shape. I think if they really got out of shape, they would feel so bad. They would go back to, you know, the way they lived their life in the NBA.
We hear a lot of stories about these superstars in all the sports partying, you know, drugs, alcohol, that whole thing, you know, wild women, whatever. What about that? Is that a myth or is it something that you deal with when you're working with these guys? Like you got to lay off the booze or you're partying too much?
No, I wouldn't say it's a myth. I think they're just like anybody else. You know, if you're 25 and you're playing 100 games a year and you make $20 million a year, are you going to go out and have fun once in a while? Yeah. But I think the CEO or the one of the top guys that, you know, let's say Microsoft, who's 28, is going to do the same thing. So I don't think it's any different than anyone else. You know, the difference is that they're in the spotlight. So if something happens or something goes wrong, if someone has a little too much fun, it's on, you know, it's out there in ESPN, TMZ. So we hear about that more. You know, mm-hmm. no one cares about the, you know, the executives at IBM or whatever, you know. So it was definitely say it's a myth. It's just, you know, these guys definitely, it was social media and all that stuff now and cameras on the, you know, on the phone. You know, you make one little mistake, it's going to be, you wake up to your pictures of yourself in the morning on ESPN. So you just got to be, you know, you really got to be careful nowadays. Not like it was even, you know, 20 years ago. You can go out and know where you are.
I'm kind of interested in something you said early on about how much you talk to your clients when you're in a training session. You said you don't do a lot of talking. You make them work a lot. So a trainer who's very chatty and chummy, that's really not getting the job done?
No, I think if you're working out for an hour and I'm talking for 20 minutes of it, now we're talking 40 minutes of training instead of mm-hmm. an hour. So not that I don't talk, but I don't stop and talk. You know, I'll tell a guy, just keep going and I'll talk or I'll critique them maybe after the workout. Hey, listen, tomorrow we do that, do this. But if you keep stopping and stopping and stopping, you know, now you're giving them rest, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, it's just, it doesn't really become efficient. So no, I'm not about, you know, some of these trainers and, you know, the local Gold's Gym, it's like, you know, they're chatting for an hour.
Yeah. No. And I agree with that. I go to a boot camp and yeah. It drives me nuts when people are like chewing the fat.
You know,
what are you there for? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 45 minutes. Let's use it for what it's there for. yeah. So the profession has really grown in the last decade or so. I mean, are you like a certified trainer or anything like that? Because that's becoming a thing.
No, I mean, because it's just on the court skill work. So, like, there's no certification process to do that. I mean, I've studied the body a lot when I was actually doing the lifting part with these guys. But now with just the basketball stuff, it's kind of just my own certification.
You got your reputation. Do people come to you for training on how to become a trainer?
Yes, definitely. It's definitely, I've had interns that kind of rebound for me, just kind of be around me every day.
Mm-hmm.
I've had, you know, DVDs out, I send people DVDs. I've done coaches clinics on how to train players. And I'm all about that. These 2-minute trainers out there are secretive and this and that. You know, I don't like that because I was one of those kids once that, you know, just wanted to learn. But the difference was when I started doing this, there wasn't anyone like me, to be quite honest. So I kind of had to teach myself. So it's why I really like, you know, teaching these other kids to come and want help.
How long do you want to do this? Do you want to be a trainer forever? Or did I read that you're, you know, you may be interested if the right offer came along to coach?
Yeah, I think the perfect job came. I've been offered a few NBA jobs over the years. Just wasn't the right time or job or stability. Yeah, but I do a lot of corporate speaking now, networking and building relationships and things like that, which is going very well. So, you know, I do not want to be a trainer now until I'm 60. So it's something came along the next, you know, 5 to 8 years. It's something I would definitely consider. I've been doing this now full time 15 years, and it's a lot of my body, too. I'm training some of these guys.
Well, that I heard you do get involved, and you're running down the court with them a lot of the time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm all in. I'm talking trash. I'm bumping these guys. It's funny because, you know, they're done after 1 hour. Then I have another guy. Then they're done. Then I'm another guy. So they're going an hour. I'm going like 7 hours.
Right.
Stop. You know, you go 1 hour. I got 6 more workouts to do.
That's right. I just only have about 30 seconds left, but I'm interested in your perspective on college athletics and college athletes. Do they get access to someone the likes of you?
They do. I mean, anybody could train with me.
Okay.
But, you know, college athletes or just anybody else, you know, need to pay for it, you know. So
yeah,
if they're willing to pay, I'm willing to train.
That's the problem. Well, thank you so much, Rob McClanahan, for talking to us about it today. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Rob McClanahan, professional trainer, author of the new book, Network, Training the NBA's Best and Finding the Keys to Greatness. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.